Today's show is brought to you by Underbrush, a new thriller by Kevin Carr. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's new movies are King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, Snatched, Lowriders, Three Generations, and Citizen Jane, Battle for the City. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup this week with a spotlight on the autopsy of Jane Doe. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/kevincarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First up with some news, another little piece of sad news. We've had another celebrity death, and that is Michael Parks, rest in peace. He died at age 77. The cause of death has actually not been released yet, but he was in his late 70s. He died at home. You know, he had a long life and a long career, but he was never that big leading man. He actually found most of his success in the last 15 or 20 years with the independent filmmakers of the 90s. So the people that came on the scene when indie film became very chic in the 90s, sort of like the stuff that was written about in a lot of these famous filmmaking books, like Spike Mike Slackers and Dykes, which was a real famous book about independent filmmakers. People like Kevin Smith and Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez. These guys were the ones that really kind of gave him a resurgence in his career. Robert Rodriguez, of course, put him in From Dusk Till Dawn. Quentin Tarantino used him in Kill Bill. Kevin Smith used him in his last two films. And say what you want to about those films, Michael Parks was always good in them. He was a great actor and very intense. And even in a movie like Red State, he still committed completely. And even something like Tusk, which isn't, it's just kind of a mess of a movie by Kevin Smith, he was one of the best parts of that film. So it's sad to see Michael Parks go, but it was nice to see him get a certain level of credibility and a certain level of stardom in that indie world that had kind of eluded him through much of his character acting career. So yes, Michael Parks, sad to see you go. The next piece of news is Hellboy, you know, the movie with Ron Perlman, the series. They made two of those movies. Neither of them were huge hits. I always liked them, but they are now going to be rebooting that completely. And it's not going to be Hellboy 3. It's going to be a brand new version, and it's getting an R-rated horror reboot. It's going to be starring David Harbour, who's probably most recognizable now for playing the sheriff on Stranger Things. And this is obviously on the heels of movies like Deadpool or Logan, the films that sort of legitimize the R-rated comic book movie, which isn't entirely accurate. There have been other well-known R-rated comic book movies in the past. I mean, probably the best well-known one is 300. But since Deadpool and Logan were such huge hits and such massive performances, now Hollywood is going after R-rated properties. That's going to last as long as the trend lasts, because as soon as we get a couple of these high-profile R movies that don't do well, and the analysis comes back that it might have done better if it was PG-13, you know, something which is what happened with Watchmen and Punisher Warzone. These kind of movies that had come out post 300, these movies kind of stuck a knife in the ability to make R-rated comic book movies. And it wasn't until Deadpool and then Logan, you had that 1-2 punch that suddenly you're like, oh, this is viable. And it all depends on the story. So will Hellboy, the R-rated horror movie version of Hellboy, be any good? I don't know. It depends on how well the movie's made. If it's a crappy movie, it's not going to do well. If it's a good movie and it connects with an audience, it'll do well. But that does not mean that the entire trend is going to be different, and that does not necessarily mean we're going to get an R-rated Superman movie. I mean, yeah, we had the Batman versus Superman R-rated extended cut, but theatrical release, I would not hold your breath. The last piece of news is one of the bizarre things that has shown up, and in this, in 2017, why would you expect anything else? Dwayne Johnson has come out and said that he might be considering a run for president. Because, I mean, why the heck not? I mean, right now, I don't care where you stand on the political angle, you have to look at what's going on in American politics in the last 6 months to a year and realize nothing's out of the realm of possibility. So how well would Dwayne Johnson do? I don't know. I mean, I think a run for president would probably impact his acting career in a negative way, because at a certain point you have to choose a side, and at a certain point you're going to alienate half of the voters. At some point, you know, no matter how likable you are on screen, you're going to have to say, I believe this or I believe that. And you are going to have to, you know, pun intended, quite literally politicize yourself. And that is the danger of going into politics if you're a well-liked actor just because you have charisma on screen. Ronald Reagan didn't do it until well after his career. So that's why it worked. But it's not like Reagan could have come back and started making movies after he was being the governor of California before he even ran for president. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is The Big Sick, which opens later this summer on June 23rd. You're bad, man.
I have to tell you something, babe. I've been dating this girl. She's white.
A white girl?
Hey, you can't look like you and yell white girl.
It's okay. We hate terrorists.
I wonder who that could be.
I'm guessing it's a young, single Pakistani woman.
You know how we have arranged marriage in my culture?
Can you imagine a world in which we end up together?
I don't know.
There's an infection. We put her in a medically induced coma.
You should call her family.
Thank you, Kamala. We're going to handle things from here.
This stars Zoe Kazan as the girl in it, but the main star is Kumail Nanjiani, who most people recognize. I think he's in Silicon Valley, that show. And he shows up in a lot of movies as he's one of these famous Indian comedians. I mean, you've got like people like Aziz Ansari and, you know, a couple other people that show up in a lot of these shows. You know, of course you got the guy from The Big Bang Theory. This guy is shows up in a lot of movies and TV shows and a lot of comedies, and he's very funny. So it's sort of wrapped around his character because, and you can kind of get it from the trailer because the trailer blasts through a lot of the story. He's dating a white girl and they like each other, but he's of course having to deal with the arranged marriage that his parents are trying to force on him. And he's kind of like not let anybody know that he's dating a white girl. And then when she has to be put into a medically induced coma, he has to confront her family, who is a bit, let's just say they're a little bit leery of him. And maybe just because the daughter never talked about him, or that they broke up, or maybe it's because he's Pakistani. And this is interesting because it's another one of those movies that deals with arranged marriage. And I've said this before on the show. I have a friend who's from an arranged marriage. He's Indian. And he comes at the arranged marriage as not an absurd thing, but he comes after to say it's a cultural thing and it worked for him and he's very happy and his wife's very happy. So I'm curious to see how this works. This is going to be a typical, they're going to see a lot of these themed movies, especially with Pakistani and Indian filmmakers and comedians when they're trying to resolve these sort of traditional issues with modern American society. So it looks interesting. I'm curious to see this movie because I want to see kind of how they handle the issue. The next one I want to talk about is Woodshock, starring Kirsten Dunst. It opens on September 15th.
Are you sure you want to do this?
How's Teresa? She's just, you know, Teresa.
You ever regret it? Cutting everything down?
Teresa, what did you do?
I remember seeing the poster for this, and I remember hearing a little bit of buzz from this, and I said, oh, is this going to be a horror movie? Then you watch the trailer, it's not literally look like a horror movie. It looks like a Dream Logic, almost a Terrence Malick kind of movie, where it's unclear about exactly what's happening, because I couldn't tell you what's happening. Apparently, she does something that is daring or dangerous or possibly illegal after being confronted with grief, and it's her dealing with it and sort of in this drug trippy thing. I don't know. The trailer just looks like it's maybe a 15-minute movie that's stretched out with long shots and heavy music. I was looking forward to this just from the poster. And this shows how marketing can change things. But then when I saw the trailer, I'm like, yeah, this isn't what I thought it would be. It's not a horror movie. Certainly doesn't appear to be one. Not necessarily looking forward to this one. That is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Snatched and Lowriders. Lowriders.
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's get ready to jump right into the movie reviews. Let's start off with Snatched. Amy Schumer plays a woman vacationing with her mother who get kidnapped and are forced to fight their way free.
What brings you down here? You're on vacation here with your boyfriend?
No, I'm just here with my mom.
Listen, I need your help. Mom and I got kidnapped.
State Department.
My mom and sister. They've been taken. I imagine you have a commando squad. Four underground criminals who were tried for a crime they didn't commit.
Sounds like the A-team.
It is the A-team. Do you have an A-team?
This is actually a true thing that happens. I mean, it's an absurd comedy. It goes into the sort of screwball comedy. But this actually happens in some countries. There was a movie called Sequestro Express, which... was about 10, 15 years ago, and it was about a new form of kidnapping that a lot of times, like, a tourist will be kidnapped, and they'll just want a quick ransom. Like, they want your ATM card or something like that. It's ridiculous to kidnap somebody and just assume that they or their family has access to millions of dollars that they can wire it to you, where it's much easier to say, hey, kidnap somebody and you just empty your bank account, a couple $1,000s, and boom, you're done. Then they release you. This movie takes it a little more Hollywood. I mean, it's about these two white women vacationing in Ecuador, and they go off the beaten path. They're sort of lured out there and kidnapped, and they actually ask for a ransom of like $100,000, which I'm like, I hope to God I never get kidnapped, because if somebody starts asking people I know or my family members for $100,000, I'm just going to die in a foreign country, because we don't have access to that sort of cash. If my wife were kidnapped and somebody would say, I need $100,000, I'd be like, well, I'm going to need a new wife. I don't want that to happen. But my God, I can't get $100,000 like that. I can barely get $1,000 like that. You don't make a lot of money reviewing movies, so just let me tell you that. So the original idea is actually a true-to-life thing that happens, but of course they made it into this absurd sort of screwball comedy. And I think, and going into this, they didn't screen it for us, and I had a chance to catch a very, very early showing of it. But before I even saw it, I said to some people, I said, whether or not you like this movie is going to hinge on how much you like Amy Schumer. And I think Amy Schumer's kind of a flash in the pan. I know there are some people who just love her. And like 2, 3, 4 years ago, she was like the it thing. The biggest deal in comedy. It's been 2 years since Trainwreck. It's been a while since her Inside Amy Schumer show. And just because you're a well-known comedian and you have an audience and you can do stand-up specials does not necessarily mean that you're going to be able to carry a movie. And yeah, Trainwreck was a bit of a big hit. But I think Amy Schumer, her comedy sort of hinges on the whole, I'm such a whore kind of comedy, which is fine. But I never liked that when I see guys do stand-up like that. Why would I care? I mean, I just don't find that specifically to be funny about how much of a whore you are, whether you're a man whore or a woman whore. It doesn't matter. If your entire thing is just about your genitals, it's not funny. There needs to be something more there. You can't just be like, oh my gosh, she said vagina. So I don't find her all that funny. I've never been drawn to her comedy, and I didn't particularly like Trainwreck. Now in this movie, she plays a very similar character, not as huge of a train wreck, but still kind of a train wreck. But it weirdly has toned some of her comedy down, and that just kind of makes her boring. I don't think she's that good of an actor. That's the thing. When you're a comedian and you can do comedy sketches, there's a leap between that and doing a character that actually has some depth and personality to it. And I just don't think Amy Schumer's that good of an actress. And then they put Goldie Hawn with her, and it's nice to see Goldie Hawn back in the movies again. I mean, especially her husband, Kurt Russell. He's in two big ones right now, both Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 and Fate of the Furious. So it's nice to see her back, although, I mean, her face is Botoxed to all get out. The plastic surgery on Goldie Hawn has been a thing since, what, like, Death Becomes Her. Goodness. But she's kind of boring in the movie. They don't give her much to do. She just sort of stands there and is the overbearing mother, the overprotective mother. And the problem with that as the, in that character is usually in a comedy like this, that character kind of going crazy and becoming hilarious and fun. She never gets there. The two of them are not very well written. In fact, they're boring to watch, and I don't care about their characters or their incentives. It's all the other characters around them that I actually found kind of fun, kind of interesting. I'm not a big fan of Wanda Sykes, but I thought she was hilarious in this movie, actually. I'm quite hilarious in this film, which is odd, because normally I haven't liked her. Recently, I've seen her in, I've actually been a little more drawn to, mainly because I think she's toned down her stock character. And she's sort of mellowed out and it's softened the delivery, which I think makes her much funnier. And Wanda Sykes plays Ruth and Joan Cusack plays Barb, and they're sort of former agents or something. And they're hilarious in the movie. Actually, I would have watched an entire movie about Barb and Ruth. Not develop them at all as characters, just making them absurd and silly like they are in this movie. And I'd watch a spinoff of this before I'd want to watch this movie again. But you also got Ian Baron Holtz, who plays Goldie Hawn's son, which is Amy Schumer's brother, and he's very funny. I've liked him ever since I saw him first really kind of come out of his shell on the Mindy show, on the Mindy project. And then Christopher Maloney has a small part in there, and he's really funny. It's just every time they swerve back into the main characters, they're not that good. The worst thing you can do with a comedy is make it not funny. Not make it bad. It's like not funny. Mediocre comedy is actually worse than anything else, because at least you can have the rage fueling you if it's terrible. But if it's just kind of mediocre and boring, that's the worst sin you can commit in comedy. And that's the problem with his movie. It's just mediocre and boring. So I'm going to have to say Snatched sucked.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Real quick, I want to talk about Lowriders. A street artist clashes with his father, who wants his kids to behave and help him with the family business of working on cars.
If it was up to my pops, I'd be fixing cars at his shop all day.
I got a new one in my...
This whole city is my canvas. I put up my art for free, and he wastes his money on car parts.
What are you doing? We got caught. That's my scholarship, Daddy.
Come on, your money's gonna get caught.
No. You need to hurry up, man.
You have any idea what this calls your family?
Your sons.
I can't talk to my sons. They just don't want anything to do with me.
This is from Blumhouse, which is normally known for doing horror movies. But this one is not. It's an urban drama. It's about these Latino kids on the street, and their father's played by Damien Bashir, who, of course, he was nominated for an Oscar a couple years ago. But it's a story about the kids trying to differentiate themselves from the working class dad, and he's an artist, he's a street artist. So it is this archetype that we see in classical literature about the son who wants to go into art and the, or the arts or literature or something like that. And then the father's the working class character. And we've seen this in a lot of versions of this over the years, whether it's a guy working in coal mines and it's his kid wanting to study literature at Yale, kind of like the Latino version of that. Not a whole lot that's drawing me to this movie. Damien Bashir is a great actor, but he doesn't look like he has a whole lot of depth in the trailers. They didn't show this to anybody. It was not screened, which is also a terrible sign. And then it's got Eva Longoria in it. And Eva Longoria is one of those people who had a brief but very noticeable fame that came from the Desperate Housewives show and nothing else. And in a way, she's kind of like Amy Schumer in that she had this one measure of fame that put her high on the radar and on everybody's maps. And then when that was over, she was gone. I'm assuming it's terrible because they didn't show it to anybody and it doesn't look like it has a whole lot to hang a story on, but it gets a preemptive suck because it wasn't shown.
It sucks.
That is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, and Three Generations.
Stop it now.
Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the latest take on the Arthur legend, and that is King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. Legend of the Sword. I know it's pronounced Legend of the Sword, people. I'm not ignorant. Anyways, Guy Ritchie directs this adaptation of the King Arthur legend, focusing on how he came to power from a young man.
Why is the water dropped?
There are rumors. The legend of the sword of a king, other than yourself.
He felt it, didn't he? The power.
It was Vortigern who murdered your father. But what you didn't account for is what you can do with this sword.
One of the first things you gotta know about Guy Ritchie is he's extremely stylized. And that came in very clear in his movies Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatched, which were these late 90s, mid to late 90s gangster crime thrillers from the streets of England. He's a very punchy director, and he's very vibrant, and he's very energetic. And he's had to struggle with that when he's finally defined himself outside of those movies when he made bigger films. Now, when he did Sherlock Holmes back in, 2008 or something like that, with Robert Downey Jr., it was an incredibly stylized version of Sherlock Holmes, and he took a lot of liberties with it. And to the point that I know people, like my mother, who had no interest in that version of Sherlock Holmes because she grew up with either reading the books, which are not that version, or she watched like the Basil Rathbone British versions of the films. He does to the Arthur legend what he did to Sherlock Holmes. Now, if you don't care about the integrity of the Arthur legend, I don't think that's going to be a big hindrance to you. But if you want to see a traditional Knights of the Round Table kind of Camelot movie, you're not going to get that with this movie. It's extremely stylized and has the same palette that you saw in the Sherlock Holmes movie, sort of that muted, desaturated look, which, you know, I thought that worked in the Sherlock Holmes because, you know, sort of like dealing with Victorian London, and it's dirty and it's grimy and it's cloudy and it's London, you got fog. I get that. But do we need this exact same look for medieval times? I don't know. I mean, he's got a good cast. Charlie Hunnam, while there's some good actors, you know, he's in it. You've got Jimon Hounsou, he does a great job in that movie. You've got Jude Law as the bad guy. You've got Eric Bana as his father, Uther Pendragon. The cast is good. The problem is he throws all of his techniques against the wall on this one. You see everything on the screen. And some of the things work. Some of the things kind of work as a punchy, updated version, sort of like a slightly modernized look at the King Arthur legend. And he does stuff that you've seen in other movies where you're having a conversation. This is what's going to go down, and we're going to plan this. And then they flash forward to it actually happening, which is a very Guy Ritchie sort of thing to do. And then there's like action shots with them running in the camera strapped to their shoulders, so you got a close-up of their face. So he uses a lot of this stuff out of his bag of tricks from movies like Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. But then the problem is, he just keeps throwing crazy stuff at you. The movie is an assembling of montages to, of course, make time go faster, or flashbacks to things that we hadn't seen. You know, like basically, oh, back before I was born, or when my father was in the king of the country, you could flash back to that. And in a lot of ways, I'm kind of like, I would have preferred to see a movie about the flashbacks and the montages than what I actually saw. The rest of the movie just seems a bit like it's filler. And in a way, it feels like they shot like an 8-episode miniseries for like HBO or AMC or something, and then said, nah, let's just release this as a feature film. So let's edit this together. And so they had to do so much condensing to make it fit a 2-hour running time that you had these bizarre montages that feel out of place because they feel like they should be referencing something that we saw happen in the last episode. And it just kind of goes so over the top of some of the stuff. He tries to go almost Lord of the Rings. It opens up with this big battle with ginormous elephants, literally ginormous elephants that can fill a canyon. At some point, I mean, yeah, you got stuff like the Lady in the Lake and Excalibur and the Sword in the Stone, and the Round Table shows up at some point. But you also still have to look at the movie and say to yourself, this doesn't even moderately resemble the Arthur legend. It kind of reminds me of these movies that are trying to start a franchise or try to start a series, and they start with the beginning when they shouldn't. They like Robin Hood. Remember the Robin Hood movie that Ridley Scott made about 7 or 8 years ago with Russell Crowe? He doesn't actually become Robin Hood until like the last 10 minutes of the movie. And after 2 hours and 10 minutes, I'm like, that's the movie I kind of wanted to see, not all this other garbage I had to sit through. If you want to see a King Arthur movie, this really isn't that. There's a lot of neat stuff in there, so I give some points for that. But it just doesn't hold together. It's not cohesive. And it makes me worried about like this live action musical remake of Aladdin that's going to possibly star Will Smith as the genie that Guy Ritchie's going to be doing next. So I'm going to have to say I wanted to like it, but King Arthur Legend of the Sword kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the next film, which is Three Generations. A transgender teenager lives with his mother and grandmother, struggling with making a permanent change and getting his estranged father's approval.
I was raised in New York by my mom, my mom's mom, and my mom's mom's girlfriend.
There may be mood swings, and you will see a drop in your menstrual cycle.
Thank God. The hardest part of my day is knowing everybody still sees me as a girl.
Why can't she just be a lesbian?
Because she's not a lesbian, Mom. She's a boy. I just want to be normal.
Why is normal the goal? What about being authentic?
Authentic is what he wants to be.
Good answer. That is a good answer.
Now, before I even talk about the movie, I'm just going to start and apologize to anybody in the trans community listening to this. I know I'm going to get my pronouns wrong at some point. And part of the reason for that is Elle Fanning, who is a woman or a girl, is playing the character of Rey, who was born Ramona. And of course, it's all preoperative, but she identifies as a boy, so uses the term he. It's going to be very hard, and I know I'm going to get it wrong at some point. So already, I'm just starting off and apologizing right there. We're seeing sort of, it's an issue-driven movie, obviously, and it's about transgender, or a transgender teen, not transgender teens, but just one in particular. It's a real issue, and it's obviously stuff that's hit politics with bathroom laws and everything, but there's also a lot of confusion to some people who aren't used to dealing with the transgender community. There's prejudice out there, and this is a good movie it's, you know, if anything, it's worth seeing just to confront yourself with this as an issue and warm up to it as a reality. Because regardless of what you think and whether you think it's right or wrong, there are really people going through this. And this is a real issue. With that said, some of the struggles that transgender teens in particular, especially minors, and the reason that's important to point out is it becomes an issue because essentially Rey wants to start going through, you know, hormone transition therapies, which have a permanent effect and a biological effect. And as a parent myself, I would be concerned with doing anything for my child when they're an adolescent making decisions, because adolescents don't always make the best decisions. And adolescents, what an adolescent wants when he or she is 15 may not be what he or she wants when they're 20 or 25 or 30 or 40. So I can understand the perspective of the parent, both the mom and the dad who's estranged, worrying that this could be the wrong decision. Now, with that said, there's a lot of issues it could deal with, but the movie squanders them about halfway through with sort of this benign and kind of at times trite soap opera thing that's going on. That's a very normal soap opera that you've seen a billion times before. And I'm like, oh, they went down that path, because they're actually honing in on some real interesting issues and discussion points for transgenders and being a parent of a transgender teen and being a transgender teen yourself, that I thought that they really could wrestle and at least confront the audience with. But it kind of cheapens itself by suddenly just turning into a bit of a soap opera. They're good performances. Actually, Susan Sarandon's quite good in the movie. I'm not a big fan of Susan Sarandon, but I actually thought she was quite funny in the movie. And Naomi Watts is good. She's almost always good. Elle Fanning's okay. I mean, she's really trying as an actress, but I think this is maybe not the best role for her. Really, the strength of the acting comes from the women in the movie. So, I mean, on one hand, it's not a great movie, but on the other hand, I think it's a good movie to see if for any other reason, to just confront your own prejudices and confront your own uncomfortable nature in dealing with something that you may have never had to deal with. You know, I'm going to give it a kind of rocks just for the social implications of it.
It kind of rocks.
That is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Citizen Jane, Battle for the City, the weekly box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring the autopsy of Jane Doe. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. We've got one more movie review to cover, and that is Citizen Jane, Battle for the City. This documentary highlights the cause of Jane Jacobs, an activist central to pushing back against the urban renewal in the mid-20th century in New York City.
I say that you have a cancerous growth there that has to be carved out.
We didn't understand how high the price was until Jane Jacobs.
Jane Jacobs has written a book that advances with the power of a bulldozer against modern city planning and rebuilding.
She is the antennae that's picking up something here that no one else is seeing.
She believed the city is not about buildings, the city is about people.
She was questioning orthodoxy at a time when women were not welcomed in those environments.
First off, this is a documentary, and it's about the growth and decline and revitalization and destruction of cities. It's not an action film. Okay. I do have a confession to make. I fell asleep twice during this movie, but I had long days both times. And it's not that the movie's necessarily boring. It's just you're dealing with just people talking about buildings for a while. And if you're tired, it's going to be a bit to watch this all in one swoop. It also runs a bit long. It's only 90 minutes, but I think there's not 90 minutes of real good, solid filmmaking there. It's one of those movies, and this is what a lot of, and documentaries run into this a lot. They either have so much to do that they can't possibly cram it all into like 2 hours, or they really have a good, solid 40-minute movie, but it's hard enough to get a feature-length documentary sold. To get one that's like 40 minutes long, that's just no man's land. That is the Romulan neutral zone where you will live and die as a documentary if you're like 40 minutes long. And I really felt like this really should have been about less than an hour long and maybe an episode on like A&E or HBO or something like that. It's easy to set it up as to who it's about. It's about Jane Jacobs, who was a community activist. She started out as a writer, and she was a mother who pushed back against the urban renewal. And you saw this with her conflicting with Robert Moses, who's sort of this guru of city planning back in the mid-20th century. And there was a lot of, don't get me wrong, there was a lot of good stuff that Robert Moses did, and he was a visionary, and he was a builder. The problem was, and they point this out in the movie, at the beginning especially, they talk about his sort of attitude was about the buildings and what it looked like, and Jane Jacobs was more about the people and the neighborhood and the community. And they were clashing. And the biggest failure that Robert Moses was involved in was the projects. And you know, to me, someone like me, I grew up in the 70s and the 80s. The term the projects was just a term for the ghetto. By that time, it was a punchline to an Eddie Murphy joke or something like that. And so I didn't know about how they came about. And this does kind of track that. And that part's actually interesting, showing about how they took communities, and by building these projects that are far apart from each other and in a high rise, that it actually ruined the communities even more. And it sort of concentrated poverty in these areas. And you got really, really terrible places because of that. And that was a result of some faulty reasoning and some faulty approach from Robert Moses. He continued to want to do that. And when the automobile comes in, of course, the trying to make roads and everything, you got to put the roads somewhere in New York. And if you want to have a freeway or an expressway, you got to shut down and tear apart huge chunks of buildings and pretty much bisect parts of the city, which was devastating at times to those communities. So it does give you that look into history. but it takes too long. I mean, ultimately, you just have to show an episode, you know, the ending of an episode of Scooby-Doo from the 70s, where they're like, oh, this guy with the greedy land developer wanted to get this housing. Oh, and that was just a guy pretending to be a ghost because he's from the greedy land developer. That's basically what it was. And I remember being a kid watching cartoons, like Tom and Jerry cartoons that were made in the 60s, where they're stories about, you know, animals in the forest and people trying to bulldoze their house. Like, you know, who are the two British chipmunks in the Tom and Jerry universe? Or the Looney Tunes universe. They're like Chip and Dale, only they're obnoxious. But they deal with these sort of things. And that actually permeated all the way down into children's programming even. So, you know, now here we are in 2017 looking back on this and kind of seeing what a failure the projects were and understanding them from a historical perspective. So that's interesting. So it's an interesting history lesson, but it is a bit dry. It's also very New York-centric because a lot of that takes place in New York. So if you don't live in New York, you haven't been much around New York, you don't get a lot of the geographical references. But so it's kind of made more for the New Yorker than anything else. Still, I'm going to have to say Citizen Jane, Battle for the City, worth seeing, checking out. It kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Last week, I said that $150 million was what Guardians of the Galaxy 2 was going to make. I was pretty close. It was 146.5. Not bad at all. That is a fraction of a percent away. And with good reason. I mean, Guardians of the Galaxy Part 2 was a great movie. And it played up to expectations. I'm glad that it made close to $150 million and didn't like push down closer to 100. It made significantly more than its previous film, its opening weekend, and it's going into this weekend with $500 million worldwide. So this movie certainly earned its keep. Now, this week, I think it's going to still be the top movie. I think it's good for about $70 million. You know, about half, maybe a little less than half of what last weekend's take was. Nothing's even going to come close. I think Snatched and King Arthur are going to be battling for second on the low end of those expectations, which is about $15 million each. I've seen it as high as $18 or $20 million. I really don't. I think the King Arthur is a hard sell. I don't necessarily think there's anything really that people are getting behind on that one. And then Amy Schumer, I think people are really souring fast on Amy Schumer. And not just men, you know, I've seen people on social media, women and different types of kind of like, I'm over her. There's still people out there going, she's my spirit animal. But there's a lot of people who are like, I don't like her. And you know what they say about fast rising stars? It's been 2 years since Trainwreck. Who knows if she has any staying power after this? Part of it's because she's got that thin skin and that Judd Apatow attack response. Remember that thing where the guy made a joke about her at like the Golden Globes or People's Choice or something a couple years ago? And she like jumped out on Twitter. He was like a teenage kid and was like, come on, you have a thicker skin like that. My God, how'd you deal with hecklers when you were a stand-up? So I don't think she's endeared herself to audiences, and I don't think she's expanded her audience. And from what I hear, a lot of women don't like this movie either. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week's spotlight is on the autopsy of Jane Doe. A father and son team at a morgue must determine the cause of death of a homicide victim with no external signs of trauma.
This is the autopsy of an unidentified female, henceforth known as Jane Doe. This autopsy will be conducted in 4 stages, beginning with an external evaluation, followed by an internal evaluation.
One thing's for sure, you're not going anywhere.
Hey, Dad, I think we should get out of here.
Now, first of all, this movie is not available. It's actually technically not released yet. It's due out on June 27th as a mass market DVD and Blu-ray, but right now it's exclusively at Walmart. It actually came out last week at Walmart. So if you want to see this, you can go buy it. Just go to a Walmart and get it. Or you can wait a month and a half and get it on Blu-ray and DVD from wherever you buy Blu-rays and DVD or renting or on. It may actually be on demand right now. Now, this movie actually got a lot of buzz at Fantastic Fest a couple of years ago. And it's one of my favorite kind of horror movies. Well, one of my favorite kind of horror movies are like people in a lab doing something that they think is going to better humanity and, you know, what can possibly go wrong. This one's a different type of kind of bottle episode. It takes place almost entirely in this morgue. And I like horror movies that do that, where they trap themselves in a creepy location and they're able to carry a story through that. And it's essentially the story of this father and son played by Brian Cox and Emile Hirsch. And they are trying to figure out the cause of death, but there's a lot of mysteries here, and there's something creepy and there's something supernatural happening with this body. It's creepy and it's gory because, of course, they're in a morgue. So you're cutting open a body, and it's graphic. I mean, you've got a dead woman lying down there naked, and they're cutting the body open, and they're pulling out internal organs and brain and everything like that. So it's not for the squeamish. But there's enough going on with it. There's enough of a slow burn of it feels like, you know, like I said, something supernatural, not necessarily ghost story, but something creepy. There's something going on, something otherworldly. And that makes it interesting. And I'm normally not a huge Emile Hirsch fan. I think he looks a little older in this movie. He really looks like he's aged a bit. And that might just be the character he plays. But I love Brian Cox, and I think he does a great job. The payoff's not as strong as the buildup, but it rarely is. But yeah, for sort of this creepy, watch with the lights off kind of movie, The Autopsy of Jane Doe is a pretty solid film. And the Blu-ray doesn't come with much. It just has like the theatrical trailer and some teasers. But it's worth checking out if you want a good, solid, creepy horror movie. So The Autopsy of Jane Doe rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Couple other big releases this week. You've got 50 Shades Darker, which is, of course, the sequel to 50 Shades of Grey. Orange is the New Black, season 4, and A Street Cat Named Bob. And that's it. I need to go for the week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Alien Covenant, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, The Long Haul, and everything. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.